This is day three of this March 2014 seven-day session, and we will read from one of my several favorite texts. It's a book called Dream Conversations on Buddhism and Zen, and it presents the teachings of Musō Sōseki, a 14th century Japanese Zen master, known posthumously as Musō Kokushi. Kokushi means national teacher. There's just a little here about his life. He was born in 1275, died in 1351. He was raised in the esoteric school of Japanese Buddhism called Shingon. And then later he trained under both Chinese and Japanese Zen masters. This was just the beginning of Zen in Japan. It had been in China for hundreds of years, but now it is migrating into Japan. He was born not long after Dogen died, another Japanese master. Musō's first Zen teacher, Chinese Zen teacher, Yi Shan Yi Ning, had been an ambassador from Yuan Dynasty China. Musō's main Japanese teacher, Koho, had been an imperial prince who left the worldly life to learn Zen from another Chinese master, transplanted Chinese master. This was these early decades of Zen in Japan was a time when it really was embraced by the elite before it ever trickled down to more ordinary people. So you hear these people in his life, an imperial prince, an ambassador. It says Musō himself became a highly skilled teacher, producing more than 50 enlightened disciples. And most of what is known of Musō's teaching is found in this very text, Dream Conversations. It's a collection of his written replies to questions of the shogun's younger brother. These shoguns were these powerful rulers in medieval Japan, and the shogun's brother received these written replies to his questions. Musō was also famous as a master of the way of calligraphy and of the art of garden design. All right, that's all we have on him, except just I could just say that give you a sense of where the Western society or culture was at that time of his life. During his lifetime, Marco Polo became famous for his adventures. There was Dante, Chaucer. Gunpowder and spectacles were invented. The Aztecs established what is now Mexico City. It was the beginning of the Hundred-Year War in Europe, and the Black Death also devastated Europe. And last but not least, in 1351, during Musō's lifetime, tennis was established as an outdoor game. So here's the first entry here. These are his replies to the shogun's brother. Those who seek liberation for themselves alone cannot become fully enlightened. Though it may be said that one who is not already liberated cannot liberate others, the very process of forgetting oneself to help others is itself liberating. So I coincidentally talked about this last night just before the end of the evening sitting about how vital it is to eventually mobilize or awaken this aspiration. It's called bodhicitta, the aspiration to come to awakening for the sake of all beings. There is a very strong tradition in Japan of not presuming to liberate others, which usually means not to even teach until deep enlightenment. One has attained deep enlightenment oneself. But here, that has its merits. We're sort of going the other direction here in the West. People are becoming Zen teachers more and more easily, not to mention the teachers in the Vipassana tradition and not to mention mindfulness, so-called mindfulness teachers. But he says, though it may be said the one who is not already liberated cannot liberate others, the very process of forgetting oneself to help others is itself liberating. That's the other side of the coin. When we respond to others as best we can to help them, to share our experience, then putting their needs above our own, then that itself is liberating for us. It's liberating to be less self-absorbed, less self-centered, but to put others' needs before our own. It's a training in being aware, mindful of others and helping them. Here's a very granular example of that, but a way to train oneself is at the meals, at these meals in Sesshin. What many people do, I've been told, and is to when the people start serving themselves, is to serve oneself first and ignore people around you. The other way to do that is, okay, serve yourself first. That would never be done in Japan. When I was in Japan, you would never serve yourself first. You would pick up the serving dish or bowl and you would offer it to the person on your left or right. We're Americans. You serve yourself first, but then rather than just putting it back in the middle of the table where the person next to you has to stretch and get it, it's not going to shatter your sashin to be aware of the people around you and aware whether that person has had the yogurt yet or whether that person has had the salad. We can do that. We can expand our awareness, our mindfulness, to take in more of what's going on around us and be more helpful to those around us. We've made some progress on this at the Zen Center on staff. It used to be the first way, where people would just lunge for whatever they wanted and put it back, ignoring everyone else. But people are a lot better about that now, being aware of who's served herself bread or who hasn't, and lending a helping hand. Now, this is, of course, a tiny example, but it's just an example, very, very particular, of how we can broaden our awareness to include other people and not just our own, or just ourselves. And then to extend that into so many other daily activities, just coming and going and driving. There are all kinds of ways when we're driving to put others before ourselves, letting someone in who's kind of trapped in a driveway and no one else is letting the person onto the street, allowing the person to drive onto the street. So, you know, being like 1 second later to where you're going to let someone else in. It's not very exotic. It's just consideration and awareness of other people. But he's talking in bigger terms here about devoting. Presumably, he's talking about devoting one's free time to helping others, serving others. This is all ripening us. Every little thing we do like that, where we put others before ourselves, we're taking the kind of self-absorbed, we're reducing that, becoming less narcissistic. We may have narcissistic tendencies. You could say that ultimately all of us have some baseline of narcissism, thinking of ourselves first, but we're not stuck with that. Zen practice, sitting especially, is the best, most effective way of getting free of that narcissism. But then there are other ways that we can apply that in the company of other people to loosen up this grip of the self. And then he concludes, therefore, those who seek to benefit themselves alone actually harm themselves by doing so, while those who help others also help themselves by doing so. We just want to alter this stubborn habit force of egotism, and that's done in many thousands of ways that we can be looking for opportunities to do. And then another entry here. There are three kinds of compassion. One kind is compassion whose object is living beings as such. Another is compassion whose object is elements. The third is objectless compassion. These three kinds of compassion are very different. The compassion whose object is living beings as such is the compassion of one who thinks beings are real and their delusions are real, and who wishes to liberate these real beings from their real delusions. This is sentimental compassion, which is limited by feelings. It is still just emotion and desire, not real liberative compassion. Well, he's talking about the danger of what is a pretty natural thing, which is to see people who are suffering as somehow beings of substance who are not changing. This is radical stuff. This is radical fundamental Buddhist teaching, to come to awakening is to see that all beings are fundamentally empty. There is no enduring self-substance there. There's just the illusion of selfhood. And so long as we are caught in that illusion of selfhood, situations of where we could extend our compassion can become melodramas. This is hard. It's hard to grasp, and I think a lot of people, certainly people who are not in Zen, would not begin to understand what this means. Anyway, he's really talking about attachment to the notion of beings, and this attachment breeds and this whole overlay of emotion, and it's not real liberative compassion. Then he goes on to the compassion whose object is elements, is the compassion of one who sees all beings as conditional productions of causal relations. Okay, this is someone who has seen into the insubstantiality of all form, all beings, and recognizes that these forms that look so real, whether in people as people or as trees or cars or anything else, that these forms are conditional productions. They're causes and conditions coming together to give this illusion of selfhood or thinghood. This is the compassion of one who sees all beings as compounds of elements that have no real person or thing in themselves. This is illusory compassion for illusory beings, using illusory means to liberate illusory beings from illusory delusions. Although it transcends this sticky emotion of sentimental compassion, this dreamlike compassion still retains the image of illusion, so it is not yet truly liberated compassion. And then he ends his statements on compassion there without mentioning the third one, this the objectless compassion. This is sort of the compassion that is beyond compassion. It is responding without any idea of oneself being this noble helper and the other being this pitiable object who needs our help. And yet there is response. There is awareness of a need for someone to be helped, and there's reaching out in one way or another, either literally or figuratively, but without any, as naturally as reaching behind in the middle of the night for one's pillow. That's a wonderful image in a koan, like one reaching back with outstretched hands for the pillow in the middle of the night. Next, there is ultimately no means of safeguarding anything in this world. Anything you gain can be lost, destroyed, or taken away. For this reason, if you make the acquisition and retention of goods or status your aim in life, this is a way to anxiety and sorrow. Well, this is just hardcore Buddhist realism. Anything you gain can be lost, not just can be lost, but will be lost. Relationships, goods, things we buy or inherit, our bodies. We acquired our bodies when we were born. They will be lost. And I'll read these great words from Milarepa. He's a, I think, 12th or 13th century Tibetan, great Tibetan enlightened monk. All worldly pursuits have but one unavoidable and inevitable end, which is sorrow. Acquisitions end in dispersion, buildings in destruction, meetings in separation, births in death. Knowing this, one should from the very first renounce acquisition and heaping up and building and meeting, and faithful to an eminent guru, set about realizing the truth which hath no birth or death. Well, this is real pure monastic way of understanding things. One who really takes this to heart would become a monk or a nun. These words, especially about the building, buildings end in destruction, are words that have come to me probably hundreds of times since we were given Chapin Mill and we set about building Chapin Mill. That it is, of course, only a matter of time before this complex, these buildings are gone. Hopefully it'll be centuries from now rather than in a fire. But temples, monasteries in Asia are burning down all the time. And then they rebuild them, okay? But with the awareness that it's all impermanent. How many people can enter into a relationship, either a romantic, intimate relationship with someone or a friendship, with the awareness that it's only a matter of time before you're separated from that person? This is what we're up against. This is the human predicament. What can we do? We can sit. We can come to Sesshin. And no doubt still suffer pain when the building burns down or the relationship, someone dies. But at least it's with awareness. It's less attachment. And with less attachment, there's less suffering. If we know that something, someone can be taken away from us at any time. When he says, if you make the acquisition and retention of goods or status, by the way, your aim in life, he's not saying don't build anything, don't enter into relationships. But if that becomes such a priority in your life, this is a way to anxiety and sorrow. The anxiety comes from the awareness that we can lose it, or him or her, at any time. The sorrow comes from when we do. But there's different degrees of sorrow. You notice here, he says, he doesn't say, if you make the acquisition and retention of goods your aim in life, you're bad. It's not a moral thing. It's just this. He says this is a way to anxiety and sorrow. This is a way to incur suffering. It's the marvelous thing about true Buddhism is you don't have to talk about what's right and wrong. It's a question of whether what you're doing or saying or thinking will lead to suffering or not. That's all. Don't bring good and bad into it. This is what makes it almost like a science. You do this, and that happens. If you don't do that, then that won't happen. And the choice is ours. There's no wrathful God to exact punishment on us. It's just our own actions, cause and effect. And here he's again addresses the human predicament. It is a characteristic tendency of human beings to indulge in emotions such as happiness, grief, or anger in response to present conditions, failing to balance these feelings with the awareness that present conditions are results of past causes. It is illogical to face the present only as an object of enjoyment or tolerance, neglecting to use it as the opportunity to create the future. Well, there's something so unevolved, he's saying, about just celebrating when we're happy, or falling into deep grief or misery when we're sad, because what's happened has happened, and now we have the opportunity, he says, to use what has happened as the opportunity to create the future. I just find myself thinking back to when I read the word grief, to this terrible grieving of the relatives, the family, mostly Chinese, of the passengers of that plane that disappeared, hearing and seeing clips of their wailing and distress, and understandably, of course. But then, okay, so now what? It would be wonderful to think that some of them at least would turn toward practice, spiritual practice, as a way to mitigate future suffering, because of course there will be more suffering when you lose others close to you. What is all too common when suffering a loss like that is to blame others. And then, of course, the same with when fortune comes to us, fortunate circumstances. It's also so pathetic in a way to just get wildly joyous and blow one's sense of composure because things are great right now. Winning the lottery. And now continuing with this theme of causation, he says, causes are complex and have different time scales. The efforts of the individual are not the sole determining factor in the individual's condition in life, because everyone is part of the nexus of society and nature and the continuum of time. It is common for people to attribute causes wrongly because of misperception of real relationships. So, when we're introduced to the doctrine of karma, causation, some of us can oversimplify it. You know, I got in an accident, a car accident now because I did such and such. Or I was cheated by so-and-so because of I did such and such. It's, we don't know. We can't know the causes of these things. A couple months ago, 3 months ago, one of our Sangha members had his house burned down, and he was ever since been reflecting on karma, and I don't think there's much to gain by trying to establish a cause of that effect of a house burning down. What's important is how we are behaving, how we are leading our lives now, which is where the Dharma comes in. The more we can avoid actions and words and thoughts rooted in greed, anger, and delusion, the more likely we will, or the sooner we are likely to free ourselves of this obstructive karma. Karma is not something you have to believe in necessarily. Certainly, you don't have to come to awakening. The only thing you have to do to come to awakening is get beyond thought. But there is a lot that the belief in karma can establish a strong sense of order and connection to our lives. Zen Master Dogen said, "Those who would practice the Dharma must deeply, deeply feel the passing nature of things and have faith in karma." Have faith that if we haven't reached a point in our practice that we have always aspired to, if we feel blocked, that's not some mistake. There are some causes and conditions that are behind that, and that those causes and conditions are always changing, then we are helping them change. The worst thing is when people say, well, they're usually are feeling despondent or self-pitying. They say, oh, this is my karma. Blah, my karma. Such a silly idea to think that there's some static, unchanging saddle on our back that we just can have to kind of labor under in vain. God, if you want to change your karma, do zazen. If you want to really change it, come to Sesshin. It's a dynamic thing, this what we call causation, karma. We are every time we detach from thoughts and we turn our mind to the realm of no thought, which is the breath or the koan, whatever. Every time we do that, we're changing our karma for the better. He continues. Every cause is the effect of something else, and every effect is the cause of something else. What may seem a curse may be a blessing, and what may seem a blessing may be a curse. Hardship is a blessing when it spurs effort and development. Ease is a curse when it increases complacency and self-indulgence. Again, we need to be mindful whether we're facing a blessing or we're facing a curse, to be mindful that it will pass and become something else. People who are blessed with good health are fortunate, wonderful. You can practice more. People who are afflicted with some kind of illness or injury, wonderful, you can practice more. You can use it as a spur to get more serious about this matter of change and our mortality. I have this story about the lost horse that I don't know when I last read it, but if it was recently, then my apologies, but I'm going to read it again. This is an old story from China. In ancient times, there was a man who lived on the northern frontier of China. One day, for no reason, his horse ran away to the nomads across the border. Everyone consoled him, but his father said, "What makes you so sure this isn't a blessing?" See, the father doesn't know himself, but he's advising his son not to be too hasty in drawing conclusions that he's so unfortunate. Some months later, his horse returned, bringing a splendid nomad stallion. Everyone congratulated him, but his father said, "What makes you so sure this isn't a disaster?" So now their household was richer by a fine horse, which the son loved to ride, but one day he fell and broke his hip. Everyone consoled him, but his father said, "What makes you so sure this isn't a blessing?" And then, a year later, the nomads came in force across the border, and every able-bodied man took his bow and went into battle. The Chinese frontiersmen lost 9 of every 10 men. Only because the son was lame did father and son survive to take care of each other. And then the conclusion is, truly blessing turns to disaster and disaster to blessing. The changes have no end, nor can the mystery be fathomed. I bet a lot of you have stories where something terrible happened that you thought was so terrible at the time, and then turned out to be quite different, leading to opportunities, and vice versa. Something that seemed so wonderful that then had other consequences. Actually, as an example of this, there's a in the lead up to this, in the introduction to this book, the translator Thomas Cleary just sketches out a bit of the conditions in Japan at the time of Musso's life in the 13th and 14th century, and he said that there was this great victory in the 1280s, where the Mongols invaded Japan, and there was this natural force that came to be called kamikaze, which literally means spiritual wind. It was a natural storm that blew up, that repelled the invasion of the Mongols. And also that plus a tremendously valiant collaborative defense staged by truly heroic warriors from all over Japan. And then he says, ironically, the salvation of Japan from the Mongolian invasion also planted seeds for the downfall of the military regime. And he says that it was the custom at the time, in these feudal times, it was the custom that when you were really courageous in battle, you were rewarded with a land grant. But so many of these great Japanese warriors, there were so many of them who distinguished themselves in repelling the Mongol invaders that it drained the coffers of the government at the time. And then there were those, the warriors who didn't feel they were properly compensated, and then they started making trouble, and that was the beginning of the downfall of the regime. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.